It's Friday. It's the day after Thanksgiving, and it's now the 47th edition of the Zogby Report, real and unrehearsed, real and spontaneous. I'm here, John Zogby, and I'm together again with my son, Jeremy. We were together yesterday for Thanksgiving. How are things?
Well, yesterday was interesting.
Yes. Right?
I mean, the last time we had all of the from my vantage point, the grandkids, mm-hmm. right? First cousins, the last time we were all together was maybe like 98, right?
Yeah.
No, we weren't entirely together, but virtually together. So, I mean, when you put it all together, what, 40 people on Zoom
yesterday? At least 40 people yesterday, and that's just the direct extended family.
And the clan is growing, too.
And the clan is growing, yes. We'll have an announcement forthwith, not today, however.
And it doesn't have to do with me.
And not me either. So, yeah, well, it does. But anyway, enough of that. So, I like spontaneity. And that's not to trip you up or not for you to trip me up. It's just I like what happens when we just talk. And so this is what's occurred to me at Thanksgiving. You know, the last three decades were very meaningful in the sense of attacking global poverty and global hunger, that enormous strides were made, especially in the developing world, where you saw tens of millions of people actually leave the so-called D and E classes, those are the poorest of the poor, and enter into the C class, and many C classes into the B class. Now, just to give you some idea, the C class is not what we would consider in the United States to be middle class, but in developing countries, you know, enough to live on, enough to have some discretionary income. And so it was an exciting time to see that. And I spent a lot of time on the road giving talks and mentioning especially to young people that how lucky they are to be living in a world where we could actually even begin to think the unthinkable, eradicating poverty and eradicating hunger. And then, of course, we have slipped back. We started slipping back with the Great Recession, and now COVID-19 is just wreaking havoc. And it has occurred to me that as part of the debate worldwide, that it's time for the GMI, a guaranteed minimum income, that in fact, morally, it's not only the right thing to do, and especially for those who are religiously spiritual, but it's also the practical thing to do in terms of, you know, ensuring that the basics are taken care of, that people could earn above that, also ensuring that people have some sort of responsibility. There has to be a means test. There has to be available work as an option, that it's not just simply as a handout. That really doesn't help anyone, but that it really is time that we get serious about this. And clearly, there is enough money to do this because income distribution, income inequality actually has gotten worse. And that's another issue that needs to be attacked. And so I have pretty strong feelings about it. And so I would like to talk about that today and to see how you feel about the guaranteed minimum income.
Yeah, I mean, my first question is, and when you talk about the universal basic income is how we call it in the Western world. Maybe that's the broader terminology around the globe. But I mean, are you talking about on a nation by nation case, or are you talking about administrated at the global level?
As you know, I am not opposed to a global government or global cooperation where no one nation owns it. I'm not a big fan of what nationalism has done and that it's time to move on to the next step. But I think the important thing here is less the details of the process, which I'm happy to talk about, more importantly, the content, that this be established, and it can be, whether it's the United Nations agencies, or it's nation by nation, but this needs to be done, and it needs to be worldwide.
Why do you think it would work?
Well, a lot of what we have is not working, and given the sufficient wealth and sufficient wealth creation mechanisms that we have, it pains me to really see income inequality growing. Mm. Stemming the tide for a while, but growing. And growing not only in a wealthy nation like the United States, but, you know, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere, where, you know, you have people overtly taking advantage of government, even government aid programs, spending it on themselves and hoarding it. You know, I'm thinking of Vladimir Putin. I'm thinking of Hosni Mubarak. You know, I'm thinking of people who have no reason nor right to hoard money. While there are those still living in the D and E classes, what we need to do is start. I know that this is a controversial term, redistributing income to be fair to people, with responsibilities on the recipient's end. But yeah,
how does it work? I mean, is there one currency? Is the currency still like we have today, where we have national currencies and we have money in our account, or we can withdraw our money? Because I ask these questions because this kind of ties into the Great Reset, which we know is something being discussed at the highest levels. This is, of course, the topic. The Great Reset is, I've mentioned before, the number one topic of the World Economic Forum in January of 2021, held in Davos. The most powerful people in the world, the richest people in the world, heads of government, are discussing these things. And so before we talk about, you know, you're saying that there's a lot of merit behind it and how this would, you know, move us forward, alleviates pain and suffering. But how is it to be rolled out? Is it, we have, what, hundreds of national currencies. So do we have a global currency? And is that global currency digitalized, meaning that it can never be taken out of an account, and it is held into an account, and that there's an eradication of paper currency?
See, I think, I mean, you ask very good questions, and it's good to go beyond the conceptualization of the guaranteed income, but those are issues that are taking place anyway. I don't know that I'm going to live to see it, but I may. You will live to see global currency. You will live to see the non-paper. Well, we're already heading in that direction, heading in the direction of non-plastic, too, for that matter. Obviously, there are a lot of kinks to be worked out, but there were kinks to be worked out. I'm reading a book about the American Revolution right now and the paper currencies that existed during the American Revolution.
The Continental.
It ain't worth a Continental.
Ain't worth a Continental, yeah. I was just going to say that.
But we got that straightened out, and it functioned for, you know, 200-plus years, except that there was always this nagging problem of poverty.
Yeah. So you talked about redistribution. And what if people don't want to participate?
Then they don't.
They don't have to.
No, which don't? The on the receiving end or on the...
Well, both. I mean, you know, if in the, at least up until this point, when, say, a factory owner or an entrepreneur or a business owner felt that they were getting milked too much, they would flee, or they would build a factory elsewhere, right? Or they would just up, you know, and move their entire operation. But if this is on a global scale, and there's a global governing body that says, you know, this is to be the way, and there is going to be worldwide redistribution, I would imagine that there would be a lot of people, whether they were middle class or upper middle class or upper class or even some rich folks, who would not be on board with that. And so my question is can they opt out, or do they have to go along with the plan?
So I think what makes sense is not one size fits all, but that basically steps are taken. So first is that it's voluntary. Second, that there are, for want of a better word, test markets. If not on a national basis, then in pockets throughout the world where, let's say, the poverty is the highest and extreme wealth does exist. I mean, that could be on a sub-regional level or a town or city level to test it, but to test it on a voluntary basis. What makes me think of that is we are friends with Ralph Nader. Ralph is very close. And Ralph wrote this fascinating book. It's semi-novel, semi-real, called How Billionaires Can Save the Planet. And I highly recommend it.
Interesting coming from Ralph Nader.
Interesting coming from Ralph Nader. The whole thing is. But essentially what he lays out...
I mean, in the old days, it would seem like Ralph Nader would write how the super rich can read the world, and then the subtitle, God Help Us All.
Yeah, but there's no God Help Us All in this one. What he says is, and he uses real names. I mean, Bill Gates and
Warren Buffett
are all in there. And none of them, incidentally, have sued Ralph Nader as a take me out of there or whatever. But essentially, what Nader does is he pools their skills. You know, some are geniuses at investment.
Yeah,
they're all geniuses at investment. Some are geniuses at infrastructure and solar technology and green technology, jobs creation, and so on. Some are geniuses at communications and obtaining publicity and applying pressure on governments. You know, a call from you know, an Elon Musk has an enormous amount of value when it comes to lobbying. But basically, you know, the underlying feature here is, why not pool these resources, not to steal from them, but these are folks that already recognize that they've made too much money already. So on a volunteer basis, let's try that first. They give up their money and it goes in a direction that actually puts real money into circulation and grows the economy from the bottom up.
So I believe in 2015 or 2016, Norway piloted a version of the universal basic income. Now you could say, well, you know, that's a pretty monolithic population. Mm-hmm. Is that the right place to do, you know, a test ground? Because it's certainly not Africa. It's certainly not, you know, Nicaragua or El Salvador. But the truth is that Norway, since I believe at least 2010, has had a lot of migrants from the Middle East and from Africa, war-torn places poverty-stricken and increasing. I mean, you know, waves of tens of thousands year after year. So, I mean, actually, maybe it was an interesting test ground because you do have the element of the those from the extreme poverty, and as well as, you know, one of Europe's most successful nations economically, maybe not side by side, but living within the same borders. And to my knowledge, it failed. It didn't do well. Now, maybe that was because it was the first time around. But, I mean, look, make no mistake about it. the stuff you're talking about is on the agenda,
mm-hmm.
and it will be pushed through. There's no question about it. I mean, each day it's being unraveled what this great reset is about. If you're not familiar with it, I mean, check out the World Economic Forum's homepage, and they mm-hmm. go into great detail. What it is essentially hitting the reset button, but it doesn't stop there. It's you could kind of see it as like a controlled demolition and then building society back up.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the end game is the fourth industrial revolution. And so, you know, talking about global minimum income or universal basic income is really just a small part of this vast project to radically alter the world that we know. Klaus Schwab, who heads the World Economic Forum, wrote a book about the Great Reset and the Fourth Industrial Revolution. And the thing that jumps out to me in what he talks about is that the biggest thing of all of this is not the universal basic income, but the very nature of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is to take all biological aspects of human life,
mm-hmm.
to take all of the physical aspects that we engage in, such as smart devices, and to take the digital artificial intelligence and to merge them together as one, which is defined as technological singularity,
mm-hmm.
which means that all humans, all the smart devices in which we engage in, and the ever-evolving artificial intelligence become one.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, and I wrote about this in the fifth issue of The Intelligence here. The entire thing was about the Fourth Industrial Revolution and the data that we had. The key question is, will you participate? I think the follow-up question to that is, will you be allowed not to participate? You can imagine millions of people could be terrified by that notion of technological singularity merging with artificial intelligence. Who is in control of artificial intelligence? Is artificial intelligence in control of itself?
Mm.
And so that, no doubt about it, because it's been said by Klaus Schwab, is the goal of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, kicked off by the Great Reset. And it goes back to the question, will you be able to not participate if you don't want to?
And corresponding questions are, everything that you have mentioned is happening. The issue is, for me, is who's harnessing it to rationalize it and make some sense out of it all. And no question about the fact that the Davos folks and the Great Reset that they've established is an effort on their part to take the lead. Let's call it, leadership maintenance on their part. On the other hand, I mean, it's concomitant on the rest of us who don't want to see that leadership to come up with a leadership model, you know, to counter that. And then the Great Reset then becomes the great debate. You had mentioned, and this is just a side note for now, I mean, one of those issues is immigration. You mentioned in Norway, that is also inevitable. And you and I have both read Philip Jenkins.
Yeah.
And we know that no matter how many walls, no matter how many barriers, no matter how many restrictions are created, no one can, and this is something, ironically, that Andrew Jackson once said, no one can stop a people determined to be free.
Yeah.
And so what continues is this huge push southward to northward. It's just going to continue. Anybody is willing to overload a raft,
yeah,
or to swim ashore. But the point is, all of these things are unfolding all at once. Who's grabbing the reins of it?
You know, with the global migration is always happening. I
mean, yes.
It goes back to maybe 100,000 years before that, right? Lucy, leaving the Aldavan cave, I think I'm pronouncing it wrong, but the Great Rift in Kenya, out of Africa, you know, Homo sapien crossing the Bering Strait land bridge when it was still a land bridge, and then the tribes, the peoples populating North and South America. The difference is that what we've seen since, I'm going to say 2010, it doesn't have to start at that point. It's just what I'm aware of right now, is a lot of that was driven by war.
Yes.
And so that can be stopped. That's something that we can stop migration, which is a result of warfare that is, you know, sometimes sold as humanitarian, but not humanitarian at all. That's, to me, kind of Orwellian language. But I want to talk about, you know, the Davos crowd and the insistence on a fourth industrial revolution. You know, you opened with that beautiful story about poverty, and I remember a specific statistic where in China, after 1978, I believe that was about the time when Deng Xiaoping decided to introduce elements of capitalism. Mm-hmm. So they still maintained a socialist system, but from 1978 to the year 2000, 400 million people were lifted out of poverty. Now, of course, going by that definition of poverty is not going to be like we know here, right? Yeah, I mean, a good indicator of defining global poverty and how to exit it is having a toilet and running water. Imagine that a lot of the world to this day doesn't have that. But the, you know, that was done by the introduction of market forces. And, you know, you go back even before that. Now, when I was studying history, I was very critical of the Industrial Revolution. I think that was just the tendency that was in my professors, that we tended to look at the Industrial Revolution almost like a Luddite would.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality that I've come to learn is that the first Industrial Revolution did much of what I just described, what happened there in China, where people's standard of living was raised so that a six-year-old didn't have to go into the mines. Mm-hmm. Now, I know laws were passed to end child labor.
But if it hadn't been practical.
Exactly. Yeah. Market forces or the standard of living had made it so that was legally possible to do. It was on its way out anyway. So the point that I'm building up to is, how much do we need a technocratic elite to drive us forward when we see that there are examples in which poverty is lifted without the hands of a few people, like, you know, in the novel that you talk about, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Ted Turner, you know, the billionaire class, the Davos class. I mean, is that necessary to have that much power concentrated in so few hands in order to get us out of the mess that we're in?
Here's what makes it necessary. It's a table setter. It's an agenda setter. If there were no elite to drive this anything, then there couldn't be an anti-elite with a counter argument and a counter movement. And so then the debate, the creative conflict or creative play between the two takes place. The policy is then made. But I like what they did at Davos, and I like the Great Reset, not because it provides the answer, it provides the start.
I would just say that the first Industrial Revolution didn't require a meeting of minds. Think about the most incredible technological innovations up to that point in human history. Those people who invented those machines, those economists that came out with the ideas that supported that, some of the politicians who we could say enabled it, did not gather at a conference in Davos or.
But I think you'd, putting it back into context, and we'll end on this note with you getting the last word. but if it hadn't been for what they created, there would not have been a labor movement. There would not have been middle class and upper middle class reformers with a counter agenda. There wouldn't have been the reduction of the work week, health and safety laws, and so on. And so it wasn't so much a cabal that met and in the Swiss Alps and plotted, but it was very much a cabal of some sort. You know, the Jay Goulds and the J.P. Morgans and they knew each other.
Yeah, and they enhanced their power with the power of the state.
Yes.
No question about it.
They did.
But at least that was going on in one country, and then there was that dialogue going back and forth. There was a rise of populism. There were certain philosophical movements that countered each other. But again, that was in the United States, and what Deng Xiaoping did, he did at the national level. Now we're talking about doing it at the global level, and I just really wonder, if you believe in Lord Acton's maxim, mm-hmm. that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Power at the global level seems to be the apex of power in human history. So what does that look like? What comes from that? Will people have a choice to opt out or participate? Or will those who choose to opt out, will they be demonized as well, you're the ones who are ruining it?
I'll only end by saying that the technology now enables those on the bottom and in the middle to provide a powerful counterforce. But the counterforce won't be created unless there's a force to counter.
I had the last word last week. I'll give you the last word.
That was it. Stay tuned. Okay, we'll be back for number 48. Okay, have a good week.
Take care.